All right, it is time for another episode of The Fifth Estate. I'm Jay Caruso, along with my co-host, Mr. Ben Howe. How are you?
I am good. How are you this evening?
I'm doing great. And the news gal, Andrea Ruth, is here as well.
Not from Pakistan.
Not from...
You keep getting the country wrong.
Well, she's a member. She said last week she wanted to be, you know, it was going to have to be a country that was a nuclear power.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah, so.
Yeah.
She should say, I'm in Jewish-controlled Palestine. Let's see how people respond.
So, Jewish, it's officially the Golan Heights now. Yeah, today we learned officially, under no uncertain terms, that the Golan Heights, despite being recognized as Israel before now, it's now officially, Trump approved Golan Heights is Israel now.
It's hard. It's hard. There's things he does I like, I have to say.
There it goes. Well, all right. So our guest this week, he's a colleague of mine. Actually, like, we sit there. He like sits like probably 15 feet away from me when he's not in his office. Tim likes to like come out and mingle with the, like, with the commoners.
Is that an ogle? Is that like an oglescape? Like you're counting the feet between because you're looking at him and ogling. Should he be calling the authorities about the fact that you are paying so much?
I got a better question. Are you jealous? Is that what's happening?
Well, anyway, my colleague Tim Carney is here on the show. Tim, welcome.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah, and Tim has a new book that just came out called Alienated America: Why Some Places Thrive While Others Collapse. And before we get started, though, I just want to remind everyone, if you like this podcast, go out to iTunes, give it a rating, tell your friends to subscribe, all that good stuff. So Tim, just to kind of start off, give everyone a brief synopsis of what the book is about, why you decided to write it, all that good stuff, before we get into some details.
Yeah, so I decided to write it because during the 2016 Republican primary, I realized that a huge portion of the American electorate, the Republican electorate, was getting behind Donald Trump because he was the guy willing to come out and say the American dream is dead. So why did so much of America think the American dream was dead? I, you know, went around as an examiner columnist to the places where the American dream seemed dead, the places where it was very much alive, and tried to figure out the pattern. And it wasn't just an economic story. It wasn't a matter of old white deplorable men complaining that they lost their privilege. It was, in fact, a matter of the collapse of local community institutions, civil society institutions, a little league, a good public school, a church, most importantly, the sort of things that bring people together that Tocqueville wrote about that makes America so extraordinary, these little platoons, that their collapse, their erosion is the real thing that made so many people think the American dream is dead. And this is the suffering of the working class. So when we look at things like deaths of despair, rising out of wedlock births among the working class, the root of this is the collapse of civil society institutions. And it's not everywhere, but it's in most of working class middle America.
And now, one of the things that you talked about, you mentioned, is like the, you know, kind of like civic organizations. It's not so much churches, but even other things like, you know, like Knights of Columbus and other small organizations where people had a lot of community. I going back to telling people how old I am, and I grew up, you know, and I was grew up in a town of 20,000, but there was always seemed to be places, you know, kind of groups and clubs and things like that people were going to weren't necessarily church, but it was something where people could kind of get together and gather together.
Yeah, and this is becoming less frequent across America. This is what Robert Putnam wrote about in Bowling Alone 20 years ago. But one of the key things we've seen in the last 20 years is that it's uneven, and that particularly the working class is falling away from these institutions rapidly. They're more likely to not belong to anything. And the two groups, sort of, you know, John Edwards' two Americas, that's one America. The more connected America has two main divisions to it. One is the elites, the places where everybody has college degrees, and as Charles Murray talks about in Coming Apart, those are more likely to sort of cluster together now than they were a generation or two ago. They're not as spread out. So the elites have their little enclaves, and they do have really robust public schools with a packed PTA. They have a strong little league, and if they fall away from church, they've got a country club or some other sort of, a professional organization. And then there are also, and this won't surprise, a conservative listener, but there are also a lot of strong pockets of religious conservative places out there. Salt Lake City is sort of the most visible, the most obvious. I also found Dutch Reform towns in Wisconsin and Iowa and Michigan, Western Michigan, where the churches are very strong and they do a lot better job than churches around the rest of the country in building strong community, bringing people together, giving them a sense of purpose, a safety net, connection, modeling, all that stuff. So that's it's a decreasing portion of America, but there's still these pockets of really robust civil society that exists for the elites and the strong religious conservatives.
I'm curious, when you talk about the these two Americas, how much has social media broken that down? So, like, as an example, I live in kind of rural South Carolina, but because of social media and how connected everybody is, even if I might live in an area that's more what you're describing, I kind of run in the circles of DC and, the what you would call the elitists and so on. Is that having an effect on where, on how much separation there is between these enclaves?
No, because, yeah, to some extent, but what you're talking about is still a matter of elites. The truth is that for most people, technology and social media has more of a pulling apart factor than it does bringing people together. I mean, I don't know if you guys saw the story over the weekend. The New York Times headline was, "Human contact is now a luxury good. Screens used to be for the elite. Now avoiding them is a status symbol." And there's two parts to the story. One is that elites are more likely to use internet, social media, that sort of stuff, in a way to sort of connect people to do something useful, while it's an opiate of the masses for a lot of the rest of the population. And I know the schools we send our kids to have pretty strong policies against smartphones, against social media, but that's not true in most of the public schools. We send our kids to conservative Catholic schools. And so where you live still really matters. Now, obviously, there's exceptions to this, but the fact is that why do Silicon Valley, why does that exist? Why does everybody these companies want to settle down where there's a lot of human capital, a lot of high educated people? Because they know that having a lot of people doing similar work in the same place provides a real value. And it's the same with schools and parents being present. We've got all sorts of technologies, but the fact is that the best schools are still places where you have parents and students and teachers sort of physically present around each other a lot. Human contact is not something technology is going to be able to replace, but technology is displacing it in a lot of the working class.
So, Tim, talk about for a second, because, you mentioned this briefly before, but, we hear a lot about, the white working class went for Trump. The accusation, of course, has been that a lot of it is that it's based on race. That there was, this racial animosity, and that's the reason why a lot of, middle class white people decided to vote for Trump. But you don't seem to think that that's the case. Or, I'm certain there may have been a pocket of people here or there that decided they were going to do that. But Trump touched some, tapped into something that
useful explanation is the way I would put it. Everybody's a little bit racist, and good and bad motivations are behind all our actions. But it's not useful to chalk up Trump's win to, in the way that New York Times columnists do, and say, this was just sort of culturally backwards, bitter revanchists who weren't going to get with the times. That's sort of the official Vox.com explanation of it, and it's a bad explanation because it denies that something legitimately bad was actually happening in these working class places. Some of the suffering was like the suffering of the white infielders in Major League Baseball who lost their job because Jackie Robinson got it. Some of it was that, was a loss of privilege. But a lot of it really was that after the factory shut down, in part because of China trade or, you know, wages went down, in part because of immigration or competition with women or blacks, all these things that are progress, that happens. That takes away some privilege. But then what comes after that isn't just sort of, oh, poor white guy has to compete with other people. It's an actual destruction of communities. It's churches closing down. It's public schools losing their most involved, active parents. And so the schools stopping being really good hubs of civil society as well as education. And then within, the diner shuts down, people don't have as much ability to connect. Without the church, you know, they could go one town over to the church, but more likely they don't. And people don't have the modeling, the connection, the safety net, and lives and families start to fall apart. And so you look around. I mean, suicides hit their all-time high last year. You have lifespan for middle-class and working-class men going down in the United States of America at a time of peace. Like, there's clearly something bad actually happened here. So that charge against Trumpism, that, oh, these Trump supporters, it was all just racism, really misses, is a denial of the fact that there's an actual suffering going on in a lot of middle America.
Do you find that, you know, since then, that was their motivation to vote for him? What's their sense now? I mean, do they think it's getting better?
Some people do. Some people just are happy that he's there. I don't think anybody... let me put it this way. The good thing Trump has done as far as protecting civil society is he stopped what Obama did and what Hillary would have done, which is the march to drive the churches out of the public square. You know, he's not suing the Little Sisters of the Poor anymore. But the president doesn't really have a power to reverse this. So in some ways, if you're in a place, I think a lot of the vote for Trump, and not just the people who pick Trump over Hillary, that's half the country. So there's 10 million reasons why somebody would pick Trump over Hillary. So I'm more focusing on the people who didn't vote in previous primaries, but then went ahead and even like caucused in Iowa or stood outside Trump rallies in the primaries. So these are people that he pulled out of sort of political inactivity and who agreed with him that the American dream was dead. And a lot of them, if you looked at the polls of these people, the exit polls, you'd say, oh, maybe there wasn't that much suffering. Their incomes were above average, you know, they're just as likely to be employed or to be retired and drawing a pension or whatever. But if you looked at it from a different perspective, where did they live? They were more likely to live in these crumbling places with more foreclosures, more suicides, more teenage pregnancy. And so the early vote for Trump was people looking around at their, not necessarily at the whole country, but at their immediate surroundings and saying, things are falling apart. This is not good. The American dream is dying. But when that's on a local level, maybe they think a strong man is going to be able to reverse it. And I think that was part of the appeal of Trump. But obviously, he's not going to be able to. He can stop some of the bad things that federal government are doing. But in some ways, stealing the attention away from the local in the way that Trump has done and the reaction to Trump has done, I think undermines it. One of the things that really pissed me off was Trump saying, on the 4th of July, everybody tune in. We're going to have a big, you know, national rally. Okay, fine. Do something if you want. And the National Mall always has a big fireworks show. But I hope nobody stays home and watches Trump when they could be out at their local fireworks show. Right. American dream is – it's we're patriotic on a very local level. We manifest our love for the whole country with like Memorial Day parades and local fireworks shows. And so Trump's mindset is not the sort of mindset that's going to turn this around, which is a bit of a paradox, right? Because I think he was elected by people who had lost something really important and felt the pain.
What's also interesting to me about what you're saying is it sounds like, you know, I'm not a big Trump supporter, and I see a lot of problems with his presidency. And I see a lot of problems with the way that he got people to vote for him. So there's a real issue. People's factories are closing and all that stuff. But wasn't there a fair amount of fear, some of it completely unjustified, that he kind of instilled in these people as something he would solve, and them seeing him fight those battles, even if he doesn't win them, makes them think things are better, even if they're not?
Yeah, I think that's right. I do think that, and I'll make it a little more bleak for you. I think if people feel that, you know, everything worthwhile has been lost, all they want is punches thrown at the other side. Now, again, this isn't all the Trump supporters. This is some of his core base, you know, the 25% of the Republican electorate that moved to him as soon as he jumped in the race. So that's, you know, 1 in 8 Americans or something. But it's more than that. But I wrote a column right before the election sort of explaining why I wasn't going to vote for either one of these. And one of the headline was, "What if we don't want to burn it all down?" And the response I got on Twitter and in the comments and over emails was a lot of people saying, "There's nothing left to not burn down." And I look around my life, and it's not just that I, you know, have a wife and kids and a job or two jobs or whatever, but I have a parish. I have good schools I send my kids to. I have circles of friends. I have all these things that used to be more of a norm that I don't want burned down and upended. And a lot of people, the seeds of happiness and hope aren't there because those are very local phenomena, and they're not individual phenomena. That's, I think, a conservative error, is being too individualistic, and we can talk about that if you want. But that if you don't have those seeds of happiness and hope in your life, then maybe all you want is somebody who's on your side to attack the people you see as your enemies. And if that's
I think that's exactly
better,
what it is.
Yeah, it's not making you better off, but it might make you a little bit happy.
It seems like that's a huge part of the enthusiasm for him. I mean, all this stuff that's happened over the last few days, he's just got lining up victories the last few days. But
which have done nothing to improve anybody's life. But
right, know, they're not victories.
Going to jail, yeah, right. And Rachel Maddow looks bad, then that can make you feel good in a perverse sense.
I think that's what's most interesting to me, is that the things that get people the most excited, people who might even be living in the conditions you're talking about, or feel like the, you know, the factory's closed, all that stuff, they're happy and think America is great again, not because of something that was accomplished, but because of an enemy that was destroyed or narrative that was disrupted.
They're asking too little from their lives and their communities. This is one of the things. I came across this definition. I was looking for a good definition of alienation, because that's the title of the book, right? Alienated America. So alienation, Marx had his definitions, but I was looking for a more conservative definition. And Robert Nisbet was a great conservative writer. He wrote a book called Quest for Community. And his definition included people who not only were disconnected from society, but didn't see the point in being connected to it. And this was something I'd realized years before with sort of the liberal version of this, was that people who have a natural tendency to want to exercise their political muscles, and I get to exercise mine at, like, my local swim club or my parish. I'm trying to get them to re-groom the infield before T-ball season opens up on Friday. Like, I'm involved in things where I can change the shape of the world around me. That's not because I'm a liberal busybody, but because I'm a political animal. But guess what? If you don't have those institutions, you don't have a way to exercise your political muscles. So on the left, the Occupy, the Bernie types, it's, oh, well, we need to have campaign finance reform so that our voices are heard. And I think the Trump populist right, they're not seeing, oh, I can exercise my political muscles if somehow I can rebuild my community. Because when it's lost, you don't see it and you don't imagine it. So you look to where there is power being exercised, and you say, I just want my guy exercising power on that level.
Right. They see themselves up there.
And so Tim, let me ask you this. What do you attribute to the growth of, like, the federal government, you know, and not getting into the whole nanny state here thing, but, you know, just people who see these problems existing in these communities and saying, well, the government can do better.
Yep.
How does that fit into all this?
Yeah, so central the growth of the central government, federal and state governments, is one of the big factors driving this, because there is a crowding out effect that, and I go through the studies in the book of, as government through the New Deal and the Great Society expand, local charity, church charity decreases, and there's studies done sort of showing a cause and effect of that, that while some of it was happening at the same time and it's a coincidence, and sometimes it was a retreat of private charity that sort of roped in government charity, government spending, there were studies showing that actually just having a porker congressman in your district who's on the appropriations committee, you were more likely to see a bigger drop off in private charitable spending. And it works the other way. When welfare reform in the places where government spending retracted the most, then church and charitable spending went up the most. So you do have this crowding out by the government, because then the next step is, when you're crowding out the church's charitable functions, you're decreasing some of the reason for people to join churches. So thus you're decreasing the strength of some of the churches and institutions, and thus you're hurting the people you're supposed to help. Because again, what I'm arguing throughout this book is that the disconnection from civil society is a big factor in these people suffering. And so that's a big problem there. But then the irony is, some people say, oh, well, we've got all this suffering, so let's provide a solution in the form of another government program. And it's not going to work, is my argument.
Yeah, it almost sounds like the right is, to some extent, adopting forms of statism out of bitterness, is what it seems like.
Yeah. Protectionism on the factories, I argue, well, yeah, the loss of the factories was a real loss, but you're not going to reverse it with some tariffs. If you did somehow bring the factories back, they'd be run by robots that are probably made in Germany. It's not going to bring the jobs back.
I listened to you when you were talking to Jonah on The Remnant. And y'all were talking for a little bit about the evangelical voters and the Christian values voters and sort of the up in the air aspect early in the primaries. What's your take on what brought evangelicals over and past any objections they might have had?
Well, so it's complicated. We don't want to oversimplify things and say there's a religious right and there's evangelical voters. Because, again, what I found was pockets of Iowa that had these intensely involved and very conservative Orthodox churches. Everybody's pro-life, and these are the Dutch Reformed churches in Sioux County, Iowa, where everybody's named Vander something, and they go to church twice on Sundays. But they've got a real community-mindedness, a real focus on building up the people around them, building up their neighbors, helping people out. And they had zero interest in Trump. It was Trump's worst county in Iowa was the most Dutch county. His worst part of Michigan were the five Dutch counties over there. His second worst state in the primaries was Utah with the Mormons. So, like, the most intimate, close-knit religious communities in America were the least interested in Trump early on. But at the same time, Southern evangelicals voted in Alabama, for instance, voted for Trump at the same rate that the rest of the state did. And nowadays, the more evangelical and the more church attending, the more Trumpist they are. So that's, again, the distinction between the earliest people who were gravitating towards them were the ones who thought the American dream was dead. And in Salt Lake City and Oostburg, Wisconsin, and Sioux County, Iowa, the American dream is alive and well. The later people tacking to him, a lot of it is, again, he's fighting the right enemies, and he's on the right side. And I look at it from my perspective. He's on the right side on Little Sisters of the Poor. He's giving us Gorsuch, and Kavanaugh might be good too, despite being a Jesuit. And so we have maybe two really good nominees on the appointees on the Supreme Court, and there's sort of this view, okay, well, he's one of us. Now, that's sort of a generic Christian conservative perspective, including my own Catholic pro-life conservative one. But then on the evangelical question, I do think some of what has weakened the effectiveness of Southern evangelical churches is related to this, is that they're becoming political. And the last thing a church should ever try to be is exactly like the rest of the world. So if you're showing up and you've got like Christian rock with that sounds similar to what's on the rest of the radio, and then you've got some political lecture that sounds like Fox News, then it's like the rest of your week. Heck, where I go isn't even terribly traditional, but we're like saying Latin and we're chanting and we're doing all these things. And so it's very different from the rest of the week. So I do think there's a lot of, and I'm having a lot more conversations with Protestant ministers these days, and there's a lot of questions to be asked about Southern evangelicals. Is church losing its sort of sociological efficacy at bringing about good outcomes in some places because it's not differentiating itself from day-to-day life enough, and thus even from a spiritual perspective too, not focusing people's minds on the higher things, but keeping people sort of stuck in their day-to-day rot?
Yeah, I've noticed like a lot of the churches in the area where I live, and I've attended many of these cool churches, you know, where you've got the rock music and the coffee and you know, the pastor with tattoos, you know, you know, all of that stuff to just, hey, this is, we're just like you or whatever. And what I found, and I grew up in the home of a Southern Baptist minister, and it's not very challenging. Like the sermons, you know, they're not challenging people in the sense that they're trying to get them to, it's like a big therapy session, you know, where they're trying to get people to find ways to comport the Bible as like a self-help book kind of, you know. Yeah. And it's very soft, and I think that that's because there's a huge focus with these churches on growth and getting satellite campuses and, you know, church plants, and so you get that through membership, and so the best way to get membership is to not scare people away.
But
when
in the long run, I don't think that works. I mean, at least in the Catholic end, like the growing wings are the ones that again are more orthodox, because you can get the self-help other places. the extraordinary thing I found in this book was that like two opposite theologies led to the most community-oriented churches. One, you know, in Mormonism, there is really a teaching about good works bringing about salvation. And then the other, these Lutheran, these Dutch Reformed, they dance up to predestination. These are Calvinist churches. But so two pretty opposite theologies, but both of them, mostly through their tradition more than theology, I would guess, do this intense job of building up communities. And so you just look at it, even if you cared nothing for religion, you would just look at the outcomes of dropouts, teenage pregnancies, drug use, all of that stuff. And these two things have the same sort of awesome outcomes as our elites, as our richest towns, even with sort of middle, slightly above average incomes and that sort of thing.
So looking forward to 2020, then, you have a lot of the Democratic candidates who are proposing even larger, more expansive government, more than ever before. Mm-hmm. You have people getting behind the Green New Deal, getting behind Medicare for all. You know, where do you think the people are going to fall there? Because, you know, I mean, let's face it, Trump didn't win with a huge margin. He won, you know, it's like, 80,000 votes across three states that delivered him the election. What can he do in certain areas to sit there and say, well, you know, if we go in that direction, it's just going to get worse again? Or is he just going to say, hey, look at how everything is going with me in office. If you stick with me, it'll continue. From a political perspective, how do you see him getting those voters to stick with him?
So I think that the Democrats are going to help him a lot on that score. I think that Kamala Harris is basically going to run against the deplorables, because that's what she's going to have to do to win the primary. And if I
had to bet, so they're not going to be out of Russia anymore.
Yeah, you've probably heard me say around the office, Jay, that I think she's the most likely to win, and that there is a competition among a lot of these people. Now, not all of them. I think Pete Buttigieg is trying to establish that as well. He had a really good line that could have been out of my book, saying, look, one of the things that working class people lost when they lost the factory was the factory as an institution of civil society, that where, you know, you go for bonding, camaraderie, modeling, a safety net, a sense of purpose, not just a paycheck. Sherrod Brown was also talking that way. He got chased out of the race. But a lot of these people, I mean, Gillibrand and Kamala definitely are two who are going to, in the primary, run not just against Trump, but against Trump's people. Like, Kamala says it, like, we know that they're not what America really is about, pointing at, you know, a third of the country. And so that's that would do Trump's bidding for him. But to go back to some of what Ben was saying earlier, too, like, if you're running on a sort of scaremongery campaign, it's a little easier when you're out of power than when you're, I mean, what's he going to do, warn them that the factory jobs that haven't come back are going to disappear again? Because there have been good effects. You know, I love his tax cut bill, double the child tax credit, and I got six kids. But, you know, there's not a lot of the working class got huge benefits from that. It was pretty small benefits across 70% of the country, and then really pissing off, you know, the people in Westchester County, New York, and Orange County, California, obviously. I don't know. He's going to be in a tough place. And if the Democrats nominate somebody who doesn't run against one-third of America, someone who could just peel off some of that blue-collar support, I don't see how he holds on to those slim margins in Pennsylvania and Michigan.
Well, it is. What's interesting to me is it seems like his best scenario is to not really win anything substantial but continue to be fought as hard as he is. Because if he could go all the way to election day just on he fights, you know, and potentially keep his base energized enough to reelect him, because that's the thing they love the most. They say the tax cuts and all these other things. But, like, I think that if he wasn't being like he is, they wouldn't even be as excited as they are, even if he did all these other good things. I don't think it's about
that we all sit around saying, Chuck, if you just shut up and stop his tweeting, he's actually a normal president. But if you're a normal president, he'd be a normal Republican, and he might not be winning.
Right.
That's an interesting way to look at it.
Because it's pretty revenge-focused. I mean, there was many years of, not just the Obama years. We talk about the Obama years a lot, because there was so much social media element, and there wasn't as much during the Bush years. But for any of us that were really involved in politics even back then, I mean, we were being called Nazis all the time back then, and the protests were just as horrible, and the political correctness was just as horrible. It just wasn't quite as connected as it was during the Obama years. It wasn't as pervasive, I guess, or at least we couldn't see it as much. But it's been years and years of this, of people feeling like they are victimized, people on the right feeling like they're victimized.
No, and bitter clingers really struck a chord when Obama said that in 08. People really did feel looked down upon. So when Obama was caught on tape saying in a fundraiser, people in Pennsylvania aren't going to vote for me, even though they're suffering under Republicans because they're sort of bitterly clinging to their guns and their Bibles, that didn't seem out of nowhere. That seemed to be, finally, these people are admitting what they really believe.
Right.
So yeah, that sense was there. And my point, in again, is when you realize that, like, these people really have lost something, like, that's step one. That's what Hillary simply couldn't get. Obama would grant that something was lost, and Hillary basically would just say, we're going to get you more welfare and you should shut up. And that's what a Democrat would have to do to be able to, do decently against Trump.
I am
actually, you have lost something valuable.
I am curious, I'm not trying to both sides it here, but, in terms of them feeling alienated, it makes total sense. Everything. I mean, I've lived a lot of it, so I get it. But conversely, they alienate back. You know, Ted Cruz's comments about New York values, and so on. And you know how people treat elitism or even expertise at this point. You know, there's a lot of reverse alienating. Is it relevant who started it?
No, I think I do think that that is a this sort of antisocial behavior. There was an example I remember once of, you know, everybody on Twitter celebrating this, like, grandma who's Welcome Matt said something like, "Go away, I have a big gun." And so some reporter interviewed her, and sure enough, she had a big gun that she used to greet people. And it was just like, that's not America, that's not good. But, like, things were getting worse in her neighborhood, and there were illegal immigrants, and there was crime. So that's how she greeted everybody who came to her face. And so that the sort of nastiness towards the coastal elites is itself a sort of manifestation of the alienation. The decay of social trust is really the core factor in here. I just think of, like, especially in my old neighborhood, I left, like, kids left their bikes on the front yard. And you could just, if you forgot, you could just call your neighbors, and maybe you'd have to call three of them to find one that was home. Maybe like, "Hey, can you let my dog out?" And just that social trust that is so valuable. Like, if you had to pay for it, you would pay a lot of money for
right.
that. And that is this vicious circle when it starts to erode, where you realize, wait, maybe I shouldn't be trusting my neighbors because somebody just broke into my car. And then you stop trusting them, and then that sets norms of not trusting, and then people become less trustworthy, and they're out there less. And so that erosion of self of social trust is behind some of, you know, the bitterness you might see, and it's part of what can make a sort of Trump throwing punches seem attractive.
You know, on the interview that I listened to with you, you talked about, I wonder if you'll talk about it again, about the solution chapter, or the absence of a solution. have you given any more thought to that, about how is this just like, are we managing a decline, or is there
no,
a way
I,
out?
I don't think we're managing a decline. I mean, the main thing is, you know, I'm here in Washington, and so we talk about, like, what policies are going to do it. And so in Obamanomics, my second book, I wrote a solutions chapter because I got chided for not having one in my first book. And then I go back and I look at the Obamanomics solution chapter, and half of them I think are horrible ideas. I should have just stopped after naming the problem of the corporate welfare. Like a gold standard, that's not a good idea, but I put that in my solutions chapter. I don't even like a balanced budget amendment anymore. So
I didn't know you were a Paltard. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, no, I basically was, and I was throwing it in the end, like a constitutional amendment against bailouts or something. Like, none of these are going to work. And I say here particularly, it's hard to write the solutions chapter when the solution is like, go to church, start a t-ball team. I'm not the pep talk guy enough to convince you to do that in a chapter. But there are things. The first is, again, and Trump is doing it very well, stop driving the church from the public square. There's a lot of belief on the left, not everybody, but a lot of belief on the left, that religion is for once a week worshiping, like, behind closed doors. And that, remember, Obama would say freedom of worship instead of free exercise of religion. And Nancy Pelosi, defending the contraceptive mandate as a Catholic, said something like, "I do my religion on Sundays." And this idea that religious institutions should just do, like, the praying and singing stuff and then shut up and not be in the adoption business, not be running hospitals if you're not going to abort some of your patients, you know, et cetera. And that you can't, as a businessman, carry your religious convictions into doing your business, a la, you know, the cake bakers, the photographers, and the Little Sisters of the Poor. That's got to end. So that's my main thing. You know, the Ten Commandments, I think, what, half of them are thou shalt not. So my main one is a thou shalt not. The other solutions are going to be on the local level and on the individual level. It's going to be you, Ben, going to church and you know, starting a ministry or whatever. It's that's going to be a lot of it. At the community level, a lot of it can happen. You know, villages and towns building themselves to be more walkable, to be more community focused, that sort of thing will help. But most of it's going to be some sort of civic great awakening. And I think a lot of it's going to have to do with church. I keep mentioning it, and there's a church on the cover of Alienated America, because for the working class and the middle class in America, the most important institution of civil society has always been the church.
So basically the go back to the basics is what you're saying. Like, that's the way to do it.
Yeah, and that there's lots of vicious circles in my book where the causality goes both ways, but then there's also virtuous circles. You start building up social trust, and a little more comes in. And
now, will you be offended that I think that's not going to happen?
No, I'm not offended. But I mean, again, I'm running my first T-ball practice on Friday. I don't know what you're doing this Friday.
Going gambling, and then I'm going to a strip club. So no,
go kidding. Gambling, go video poker. That's what you should do. Yourself.
No, I guess I just, you know, there's a cynicism that's growing among, I think, more so among people like me who are from the right and are Trump critical. You know, I was already cynical about the left, and now I'm cynical about the right. You know, I was at the Tea Party and I sounded very MAGA back in those days, just like you sounded, you know, Ron Paulish at one point. I was very, I've said before, like I was MAGA before MAGA. But my cynicism has grown, and there's so many people like me. They're just very done with it all. And
be done with Washington. And turn it off, and then step outside and turn to your neighbors. That would be my hope, is that like the disaffection with Washington could turn people towards the human level, because that's what's missing, is people aren't focused on things where they can actually have an impact, and they're instead focused on things where they can cheer for Michael Avenatti to go to jail or Donald Trump to go to jail, where they have no control over either one of these. I was going to say Michael Avenatti or Michael Cohen, but then I realized they're both, now they're on the same side. They were lawyers against each other. Now they're both going to jail.
Oh, and his co-conspirator is Jussie Smollett's attorney.
Yeah, Mark Garagos. So, it's funny, people are all like, Mark Garagos, like they just heard of the guy. It's like, that goes again how old I am, because I remember him being hitting the TV set back in 1998, 1999 for the Clinton impeachment. He was on TV, you know, defending Clinton all the time. So, yeah, and then all of a sudden he's like resurrected now as this kind of celebrity defense attorney.
It's like the perfect storm to such a degree. Like I made a comment online that I immediately pictured Trump calling Avenatti and saying, I'm settling all family business today.
it
feels like.
Yeah, that or like the people will sit there and start saying that the Russians got to the Southern District of New York, you know, prosecutor's office. But
I think Maisie Hirono did say that today.
Oh, well, there you go.
All right. Well,
I don't mean to be too cynical. I just kind of hate everything. But yeah.
God loves you. So there you go. That's your answer. Hate everything.
Oh, I mean,
show
like,
up.
Yeah, I like, there's, we didn't really get to this, and I know we got to get to the news, but one of the things that fascinated me about what you wrote is that you touch on something that I'm writing about, and I'm more hit sort of the theological part of it, in that I think evangelical leadership, Southern evangelical leadership, that they were the reason that people were able to get past, evangelicals were able to get past their issues, because he started courting them early. Mm-hmm. And they were building sort of the "this is God's will" case, you know, for a while before people started to see Trump as a last resort. So by the time they saw Trump as a last resort, if they had been holding out, they were suddenly ready to move forward, because all of their leaders had already told them that it was okay. They had gotten the blessing. And
that makes sense to me.
Yeah. So it's fascinating, especially because, you know, as somebody who was, and Jay, I know you and I have talked about this before, the most interesting thing to watch is a lot of the people that are just super duper pro Trump right now. In 2016, even though they decided to break for Trump and some of us didn't, they would say to us, "I get it, Bo." Or,
"I understand.
You know, this isn't what I wanted." you know,
right.
things like that. And you know, I hate that he does this and I hate that he does that. And now, 2 years later, those are the things they love the most. Like they're excited about those things.
Yep.
It's just such a massive change in people's views on morality, really. I mean, there was a poll that showed the reversal on whether or not a unethical and immoral president could perform his job. And prior to Trump, it was, you know, 23% said yes. And then after Trump was the nominee, it was like 75% said yes. they just completely were like, well, we need to change this now. So it's fascinating.
It is a thing. So, Tim, you going to hang around for the news for a few minutes?
I will. I like you guys.
Like, yeah, I guess we'll do that.
It's only another hour and a half.
Yeah, it's just a little bit. So Andrea has the news. All right, Andrea, what do we got?
All right, well, it's going to be a little bit more political this time because we have the Mueller report coming out. So there's other than the, you know, college scandal, the college admission scandal, there's really not a lot of like news. But apparently, according to even places like Time Magazine, which, you know, Time has been known in, you know, more recently for having more of the more hilarious headlines. But apparently people cannot stop laughing at James Comey's introspective responses to the Mueller report. Apparently he is putting Instagram posts. He left the FBI and became a social media maven. He is tweeting out all kinds of between Twitter and Instagram. He's just putting things out, but he posted this one thing that said, "Geological time offers useful perspective."
Yes,
so that was
that
one post. Yes, that one. And then the other one that he said was, it was a picture of trees in California that just said,
yes.
"So many questions."
I saw some great responses to that one. People were like, "I think they're trees."
Yeah, and somebody was like, "Do you have a photographer go out with you and follow you around when you do these things?"
I said that this is all in preparation for a new book called James Comey Staring into the Middle Distance. Because that's all it is. Just like a bunch of, you know, sometimes when because Obama used to do this, remember?
Yes.
It would be like he's staring out the bus window for Rosa Parks, you know.
Yeah, he actually tweeted out a photo of the Hudson River that just said, "Beautiful fall day at West Point, lone kayaker on the Hudson." The lone kayaker was him in the photo.
Wait, was that Comey?
Yep.
That's the greatest thing. That's the greatest thing I've ever heard.
So he's talking about himself in the third person.
Yes.
Oh gosh.
That's beautiful.
So Tim, very quickly, what did you what did you think of the reaction? We haven't even actually seen the report. We just have Barr's statement, but what struck you most about the, you know, just on Sunday, what was the biggest thing? What was the biggest takeaway you had from it?
I thought it was much more conclusive that there was no collusion than it was going to be. So that was, you know, I never thought there was collusion. I didn't even quite get anybody to explain to me what that meant. But I was struck that it was basically saying this, you know, we conclude that this didn't happen. And so that was my biggest thing. And then it was actually interesting to see that so much of the sort of media Twitter reaction was, instead of, most of the people I followed didn't like run to make excuses. I did see some, but most of them said, "Wow, yeah, some of those folks in the media are really going to have an account." Like, they suddenly started noting that there was anonymous media types who may have overblown this. And that's when you know that it's pretty thorough, is when people are saying, "Wow, I feel embarrassed for anybody who fell for this."
I noticed that too. There were a couple of people that, and people in media too, who were pushing back whenever somebody would say this is a loss for Democrats. They were pushing back with, which it blew my mind. They were like, "We haven't even been talking about this." Like, people were actually saying that.
Yeah.
None of the Democrats are talking about this. We haven't been talking about it in forever. Yeah, we were so worried that Nancy Pelosi already took impeachment off the table. Clearly, we'd moved on. what are you talking about?
The thing that that struck me most was the two extremes. There was the wish casting on one end from the statement saying, "Well, we haven't seen the report," and, you know, of course, parsing every line that Barr issued. You know, it was kind of like when Mueller said that BuzzFeed story was crap. They said, "Well, he actually said this and this," and so they were doing right. The same thing. And then you have the other extreme who just behave like nothing ever happened, that the entire thing was made up. When once again you have a conclusive, when you have a conclusion that yes, Russia tried to interfere in our election. It wasn't just playing around on Twitter and Facebook. It was a lot more than that. They were hacking into systems. They were trying to turn the election for Trump, and they were actively trying to do it. And that's a bad thing. I mean, that's not something to sit there and gloat about. So I thought that those two extremes were there. And then, you know, I think a lot of people in the middle, but there were a lot of people who, you know, I think when they said, yeah, you know what? Okay, the collusion thing is off the table. It's done. Mueller said it didn't happen. It didn't happen. And people were just like, wow, what are you talking about? You know,
Well, it was also like, I love this view that so many people had, where they couldn't understand why Trump had been so mad this whole time. You know, if he knew that he didn't do it.
Yeah, I think it was Politico or something said, he's not going to do any healing, you know, or something like that.
And right. Can you imagine somebody being accused of rape and going through a trial and at the end, everybody...
It was the Kavanaugh thing. It was, oh, well, you know he's guilty because he's reacting so angry.
Yeah.
But with Trump, it actually made some sense. Like, he did act like he was covering something up. And I think it was because he just didn't think, he thought it was betrayal for any aspect of the federal government to be asking any questions.
And right.
I think that's why
he got so upset. And I think he had lawyers and friends who saved him from himself. I think he would have fired Mueller
and
all this, not because he was trying to cover anything up, but because he hated the fact that people who, quote, worked for him were doing this.
Yeah.
And so I just, you know, we should thank God that he had lawyers who saved him from doing what he probably wanted to do, which is to, you know, fire Sessions right away and fire Mueller the next day.
Somebody had to have gotten to him and said, Mr. President, if you fire Robert Mueller, you're going to be removed from office. It had to be like the worst possible scenario for him to kind of pull back and say, okay, I won't do it.
But I've known people like what you were just describing, that he just felt like it was that it was a betrayal, like that, you know, you've got that friend who you're trying to get them to understand that if they would just let it go, it wouldn't be a big deal. And they just keep saying over and over, but it's bullshit. Like, they just can't like wrap their head around it. Like, they just won't stop.
Yeah.
And that's so exactly who he is, you know?
Yep.
Yeah, no, this is, I have six kids, so this is how they treat one another. Yes, I know it's not fair that he got one more chocolate chip than you, but if you move on, you'll be much happier. No, the sense of justice is overblown.
Yes, exactly right.
Andrea, and what else you got?
Can we go back to calling him Mueller? Because I really miss that. Everybody calls him Mueller now. We called him Mueller for like...
I never called him Mueller. Andrea, what else do we got?
Well, just to like bookend all of that, it was amazing to me that the BBC News had a quote exonerated unquote Arkansans celebrate Mueller report's findings. They actually sent someone or had someone in Arkansas to talk to Arkansans about how they felt about the Mueller report.
So they were pouncing?
Yeah, apparently, yeah. BBC was pouncing. We won't get deep into the whole college admission scandal again, because I know we've done that 2 weeks in a row, but this is just the gift that keeps on giving, because Dr. Dre and his daughter made a big post about how his daughter posted on Twitter, "My daughter got accepted to USC all on her own, no jail time," the rapper wrote in a now deleted Instagram post. He deleted it after his $70 million donation from when his daughter was a freshman in high school resurfaced. So that must have gotten him plenty of clapback, because he deleted it.
But I don't know why, though. Why did he get clapped? That is an established way that people do it.
Right. But that was the whole thing. I mean, I tweeted out, I was like, well, he did give $70 million to USC. That probably helped a little, you know, getting his daughter.
But in defense, there's many different types of graft, right? One is to just bribe the water polo coach, which only benefits the water polo coach and, like, I guess the people who sell shoes to the water polo coach. But if you buy a building to get your kid into school, then everybody who goes to that school benefits from the brand new, Dr. Dre Medical Center or whatever it is that they've got there. And so, different types of graft have different types of externalities. And the Dr. Dre method, I think, provides more benefit to the greatest number.
Yeah, and I wouldn't be embarrassed about that. Yeah, I gave them $70 million. They got this thing. Okay, Minority got in, but it's not because of that. But hey, look what they're going to be able to do. I mean, he also gave $10 million to Compton High School. So that's a lot of money.
Again, you're having these situations where Massimo Gianelli actually made a slight against U.S. Arizona State, and Arizona State has topped the technologically the top technology schools to go to since they started measuring those stats for the past 4 years, better than MIT, better than Georgia Tech. It's not even something that is, when you're getting into these elite colleges, you're not even getting something that is quote unquote a better education.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, and somebody said something funny. Said, you can understand why his daughter went there. That's where Dr. Dre got his PhD. It was at USC. So the doctor is in. All right. So that's going to do it for this episode of The Fifth Estate. Tim Carney, thank you so much for being on with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, guys.
And make sure that you go out to Amazon and buy Tim's book, Alienated America,
or your local bookstore,
or the local bookstore. Yeah, that's right. See, do what Tim does. What he says people should do. Support the local community. So if you got a local bookstore, if you still have those, go ahead and do it. You can find Tim on Twitter at TP Carney, right?
That's right, TP Carney. Yep.
It's still not verified. I don't know what's going on here.
Neither am I. I have no idea how someone does that. Got all these no names verified at the examiner, and still I'm going around without my blue check mark.
Exactly.
The way that you did your username, TP Carney, it just always sounds like a circus.
Circus.
Just because they get
you to my house. I've got six kids and a pit bull. It is a circus.
Twitter has actually put all their blue check marking on hold, apparently.
That's what they told me, but I thought they were just telling me that. Nah, made me feel better.
Some newer people just got it because the one from a couple people from the Blaze all got theirs.
He just said it made him feel better, Jay. He just said.
Well,
it made him feel
gonna have to. We have contacts at the Washington Examiner. We're gonna have to get some people to make some calls, do some work. We have promotional people there. PR.
It's like, that made me feel a little better. Jay's like, no, a whole bunch of people just got verified.
All right, well, Ben, okay, so
everybody's getting verified right now. Yeah.
All right, Tim, well, thank you so much again.
Okay.
And hopefully we'll have you back. All right. Okay, everyone, so that's gonna do it. Ben, where can everybody find you?
You can find me at Ben Howe on Twitter, giving into my worst instincts as a human. And you can read me if I ever choose to write again, usually at the Daily Beast. And you can get my book. You can pre-order it now, The Immoral Majority. It's on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and all those good places.
And hopefully in local bookstores. All right, Andrea, where can everybody find you?
Who reads paper books? Come on.
Last week I curate the ARC Digital newsletter, and you can find me and Kimberly Ross at therightsidepodcast.us, and that's about it.
And Andrea and Ruth on Twitter. I'm Jay Cruz.
ARC Digital followed me last week.
Oh,
fancy.
So
I had nothing to do with that.
Wow.
So I mean, look at you.
I'm an influencer.
Yep.
I do like how Andrea said, she said, like I said last week, almost like, do I have to say this every time?
No. I think people just get bored.
All right. Well, I'm Jay Caruso. You can find me at Jay Caruso on Twitter and also at the Washington Examiner. And sometimes you can find me writing for those British guys over there at The Independent. So you can check me out there. All right. So that's going to do it for this.
Notice.
What's that?
the Monday Notice.
Oh, that's right. I do this newsletter called the Monday Notice. See, I you know, I forget about all this stuff. So much to do. Anyway, all right. Well, thank you for that. And, you know, so that's going to do it for this week. And we will see you next time here on the Fifth Estate.